And I think we're joined now by Christopher Black. Are you there?
Yes, I am, sir. How are you doing?
Well, very good, Chris, except both you and I know that there's been an unfortunate, the word we're seeing most in reporting this is another Rwandan national has been abducted, in this case off the streets in Nairobi. Tajiri Bambe.
Right.
And you know him rather well. I used to see him at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. I remember him as a very pleasant, very good-humored, intelligent man, soft-spoken.
Yeah. Right.
Very able. You were fortunate to have him as your investigator, but what do you know about the circumstances of his being abducted on June, I think it was June 24, Nairobi.
Right.
Tell us what you know about that.
The facts seem to be that he was residing in Togo where he had refugee status. He went to Nairobi to visit his, I think, children, his daughter and son, and his wife had recently died. Mm-hmm. And he was there temporarily, and they went shopping at a local mall. And at the mall, four men got out of a car and grabbed him and shoved him into their car at gunpoint, and when local people tried to resist, and his children tried to resist, they fired a shot and pointed their pistols at the people. And anyway, they got in their car and left. He's never been seen since, and it doesn't seem to be robbery because he had a vehicle. They didn't steal that. They had computers in the car and money. None of that was taken.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some indication the local police may have been involved in helping this abduction. It's not clear.
There is an issue, and I know from visits to Nairobi where people do put on uniforms and in some mm-hmm. cases use vehicles that belong to the police. How they obtain them is
yes.
Where you have to be. A colleague of yours, in Nairobi once told me he was coming to a roundabout. They have roundabouts in Nairobi, like right. in Britain. And a soldier waved him over to, you know, because you know, he wanted to speak to him, and he realized that that wasn't a soldier. He stepped on the gas, and his rear window was blown out, but he didn't lose his life.
Yeah. It's true. Sometimes, even in Tanzania, around Arusha area where the tribunal was located, there are incidents where bandits have disguised themselves as police and stopped people at roadblocks and then robbed them.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it doesn't appear to be robbery because all the valuables he had weren't touched.
Yeah.
And he's just disappeared.
Now, yes. And
so
of course,
we believe it to be. Yeah. The logical conclusion is that it was the Rwandan regime now in power that snatched him. And there was some in Judy River, the Montreal journalist, had some information which seems to be credible that, in fact, he was snatched by the director of military intelligence.
Yes, by the way, digitaljournal.com,
right.
July 10, Judy River, I'm glad you call attention to her work, which has really been the best in terms of following the events and those associated with the regime in Kigali. I think she affirms, and others have said, that he was knew Emil Gafarita, who was also,
yeah.
he was taken violently. At least we disappeared.
Right.
And also in Nairobi, and this was an individual, Emil was going to be a witness or certainly someone giving information to the French investigation into the assassination of Habyarimana. That happened.
Right.
His kidnapping occurred in November. Now,
yes.
And we may as well say also Mr. Patrick Karegeya was murdered it was January 1st, 2014. In his hotel in South Africa.
Right.
Now, you practice, and this is a very sensitive matter that we really need to talk about. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda asks people to participate both as investigators, lawyers, and witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and they take on the role of security for all those people.
Well, supposedly.
Thank you for saying.
As you know, when Peter Erlander was arrested, they had to be dragged and forced against their will to help him when he was in trouble there. And we found out during our trial for General Dindilia Mana that the witness and victims protection service at the ICTR, which is supposed to protect people, was in fact giving information to the regime in Rwanda about defense witnesses, who they actually were. And they were supposed to be protected, not they weren't supposed to know their details and their background, who they really were. Yeah. But in fact, we found out they were handing it over to them all the time.
Well, and I mean, this calls out. This is we just were speaking to David Hoyle, and I know you've met Mr. Hoyle. Yes. And there is this mixing of roles and titles and identities. At the end of the day, it's kind of a trick on people,
right?
Because they closely collaborate and they openly say so with that regime.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about, and this is highly relevant to this, transferring all the data, all the information, all the records of your trials into
right.
the hands of the regime in Kigali that Judy Rever and others have demonstrated are very likely it's a regime that is abducting and killing people
yes.
around the world.
And even making threats here in Canada against us, and she was one of them, I'm one of them, and other people, Robin Philpott and so on, and David Himbara. And you're right, I was on a committee, the Defense Committee, which talked to the United Nations about the transfer of the tribunal archives, and the proposal was to ship them to Kigali, and the defense said, if you ship them to Kigali, they'll make sure that even if they don't destroy them or have an accidental fire and burn them, no academics, no historians will be allowed proper access to them,
yes.
unless they're under a tight UN security, and even then we don't trust it because most of the UN departments are working with that regime, so we demanded they be sent elsewhere, preferably in some neutral African country or someplace like Zimbabwe or somewhere where in Europe where people can actually get access to them.
Can you report any progress on that front, by the way?
We were told our views were taken into consideration, and that's the last we heard of it.
Uh-huh.
That's the usual answer you get, that your views are duly noted, and then they leave the room.
And let's remember, we're taking this back to, here is an individual who is a very conscientious man, who was vetted, of course, upon his employment for you and other defense counsel.
Right.
And anybody who ever saw him knew that he was a straightforward, honorable individual working for the United Nations in the capacity of defense investigator. Now, he's disappeared in Nairobi. Clearly, there were witnesses. Armed men took him off the street. Where is the voice of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda?
No, none. And there's nothing from the Kenyan government. Both the Defense Lawyers Association through John Philpott, the lawyer of Montreal, who sent the tribunal a letter, and the Kenyan government, I did also, asking that they protest this breach of national sovereignty by snatching a foreigner on there and taking him out of the country, probably, and abusing somebody who's supposed to be protected by the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been no response so far. Got nothing.
But, again, of course, I understand. Kenya would be a country. Tanzania is another where people have disappeared. And, of course, people of South Africa. In each case, we need to inquire of them. But, when you think of Tajiri Bambe, that is one place where Canada and Canadians and others have a right to say this is a United Nations court.
And when in his case in particular...
So they're answerable to us.
And in his case in particular, because he was a gendarme, and the gendarmerie in the war in Rwanda in the events of 1994 were clearly, those men and women tried to save as many civilian lives among the chaos as they could. And it was proved during the trial that's exactly what the gendarmerie did. There were no charges against any gendarmes, and there was no charge against him by the regime. In fact, the regime, when they took power in July 94, took over the gendarmerie intact and kept all the personnel and staff intact. And nobody's ever been charged among those men and women. So there's no claim that, well, they may have stashed him because maybe he was complicit in some crimes or something. Mm-hmm. This man was one of those men that risked his life trying to save civilians, and he had a lot of courage, and he is, as you say, a very gentle, self-effacing, very intelligent man.
But
to have him snatched when he did his... He spent 20 years on the run just because he tried to save people's lives and was willing to talk about what the Rwandan RPF regime really did. Well,
Yeah.
Shows you what's going on in this world.
Yeah.
Double standards used.
Christopher Black represented General. Now suddenly,
Dindilimana.
Yes, funny. I can think of Augustan. Dindilimana, which was a. And now, by the way, many years of struggle and eventually demonstrating his innocence, certainly particularly on the charge of any conspiracy, etc. Mm-hmm. And just to nail down this point, because you're quite right, people like to say, well, let's see, he's a Hutu, he was in the military, he must be guilty. You pointed out in the courtroom that there was a officer of the Rwanda gendarmes who was rather a close lieutenant to General Dindilimana who was serving on the prosecution team.
Yes.
So if we're supposed to presume guilt, one of the places you might want to look would be in the prosecution team. But, of course, they had to agree with you that he had not done anything wrong, mm-hmm. and nor had our friend here.
That's right. We had a lot of evidence, and the judges accepted it. In the judgment of the general, there was paragraph after paragraph in the judgment detailing what the gendarmerie, the national police, did to try and protect people. And gendarmes were killed trying to protect people. Mm-hmm. And everybody who's an expert recognizes that fact. So there's no way the regime could just try and justify this snatching by saying, oh, well, he had to face justice or something. It's just nonsense mm-hmm. if they try to claim that. So why he was snatched, probably because of his defense work with the various teams, including mine, but others as well. And yes. he was very good at what he did. And yes. he helped us win the case and bring out a lot of real facts about what the RPF regime did in that war.
Yes. They're not only innocent. These are many cases, really outstanding people.
Yes. He's a real hero, this guy.
That being intelligent, capable, and having been a witness to those events would make you a marked man mm-hmm. or woman. In the case of Victoria Ingabire, we know something about the internal workings of that state. This is Christopher Black, and he has a tremendous record now in working on the subject of international law. Not that we see a lot of it, but you're one of our witnesses that it actually doesn't exist. Now, Christopher, you attended a conference recently in Russia.
Yes.
And there were parliamentarians there who wanted your expertise on this very subject. What were they talking about, and what kind of things did you see and hear there?
Well, it was organized by the Duma, the Russian Parliament, and some other universities in Moscow and other organizations. It was an attempt to have an international, what they call it, a round table, people, experts and academics and politicians, MPs from across Europe and different countries, to discuss what's the state of international law and how degraded it's become, because the NATO powers in particular are ignoring it wherever they want to, wherever it serves their interests, and that there is an argument, which I have here with people, is there international law or is there not? And some made interventions there is through the conventions and treaties, but the West seems to just ignore them, so my point is, well, there is no law then. Mm-hmm. But it was a very frank discussion by people from Spain, Italy, Greece. There was people from the German left there, an MP, left MPs from Finland. There was somebody from the Likud party in Israel on the right.
Mm-hmm.
There was a wide range of views. People from Armenia, Turkestan, Tajikistan, Greece.
These are parliamentarians, most of them.
Well, some are parliamentarians. Some were legal academics.
I gather no Canadian parliamentarian attended.
No, I was the only Canadian.
How did they know to stay away? I always wonder about their DNA. You know, is there something that they just sort of look and their eyebrow goes up?
The question to me was, why is Canada, from one other intervention, one other person attending, why is Canada so aggressive in its policies against Russia?
And mm-hmm.
That was, so I had to tell them to look to Washington for that answer.
Well, indeed, you have to look at the Canadian embassy, which apparently was a place that the Toronto Star identifies as protesters could go and hide,
right?
And during what they called protests, but of course, other people would. There's another word you could use: rioters,
yeah.
uh, k- killers in some instances. A lot of people got killed there.
And right, and it brings
some
into
of
question.
These people were going into that embassy and were safe and sound.
And it's and when you look deeper, one has to ask the question: were they going in there for more than that?
Yes.
Was the embassy being used as a base for organization and so on and so forth?
Yes.
As we know now, the Canadian embassy in Venezuela was used a few months ago to try and organize a coup, which never took place, against Maduro. And then we have the Canadian overthrow of Aristide in Haiti and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Canadian involvement in the events in Iran way back. We find out that the Canadian embassies...
Wasn't that interesting? Yes.
...are usually used for more than what they purport to be used for.
Another man named Taylor, and he still lives in the U.S., and one of the reasons is that he was named an officer in the CIA.
Yeah. Exactly.
In order to do it all, you can find this in the books. Mr. Volpe wrote one of them, but of the Globe, Volpe of the Globe. Pointing out Ken Taylor, in order to do the work, was named chief of the CIA mission.
Right. Exactly.
Little detail when people talk about our wonderful role.
Yeah.
Guess people from other countries did ask you that, did they?
Yes, they did. They were very curious as to what explains the Canadian attitude. I'm not sure if you're fading out here. I'm losing you. But hello.
Well, we'll have to see if we could organize such a conference here. But I think you thought it would be difficult.
I can't imagine. Well, it seemed to be maybe I think it was a sincere attempt to try and figure out how. The question was, how can we get the Western powers, especially, to obey the president? The international law structures which exist, the UN Charter and all the conventions and so on, and if they don't, what's going to be the result for the world? And it was very, very depressing analysis, frankly, but I can't imagine a discussion even taking place like that in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. We're in a phase that people seem to be agreeing. It's called the New Cold War, and how quickly everyone falls into line. There is no discussion, no group of parliamentarians doing what you might think their duty would be to go themselves and visit Russia and get the opinions of their fellow parliamentarians there in order to seek understanding. That isn't even thought about. You could not suggest that to a Canadian politician. He'd ask you to please get out of the office.
No, it would never happen here. And it was interesting to see that in the Russians, despite all the attacks against them, the propaganda, are really sincerely trying different venues to get different points of view on how they could try and get people to obey the law and recognize national sovereignty and use law to solve conflicts between nations instead of force.
Yes, which was the point of the founding of the United Nations. The idea was that the United Nations, sort of one of the organizing principles after the defeat of Nazism, was that states would negotiate. Mm-hmm. It would not resort to war to resolve differences, and they would not incite problems inside one another's borders. And if someone was accused of it, you could find an international forum in which to debate it.
Yeah. There was even a proposal by a man named Gromyko to draw up a convention to ban the use of sanctions, so-called sanctions, basically economic warfare, which is Canada's engaging in aggressively against Russia, because sanctions are really collective punishment against the population, and yet they're expressed to be aimed at individuals or governments, but really it's the people that get used are suffering through these things, and they don't work; they're counterproductive. But
This is Christopher Black. By the way, when was that conference? Can you recall the title of it?
It's July 10th. It was just on July 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I had it up. It's on Facebook. It was the Gorchakov Public Diplomacy Fund on their website. If you look up Gorchakov, Gorchakov, Public Diplomacy Fund.
Yeah.
The details about that roundtable will be found there.
Yeah, and probably if they track you, they go to Christopher Black.
It's on my Facebook page.
Follow the bouncing Christopher Black, and you will go from point to point. Now, I want to talk again, just as closing out on this point, subject again, about our friend Tajiri Bambe. The former prosecutor, chief prosecutor there, Carla Del Ponte, she parted company with them,
right?
Because she said that she wanted, she had expected that the tribunal was going to be at least a little bit even-handed, and she wanted to prosecute some RPF people, and they basically gave her her walking papers. Everybody should remember that, because that seems to be the end of the road, at, you know, in terms of any even phony effort to be even-handed. So we can say, I suppose, that the what they inherited after the departure of Del Ponte was a collaborationist UN tribunal collaborating with a regime in Kigali, which arrests, imprisons, and kills its opponents.
Right. And, well, you're right. The tribunal was...
And therefore really endangers Tajiri Bambe.
Right. The whole point of the tribunal for me was that they were trying to justify the existence of the present regime, which took power by force, and its continued rule. Just no matter how many people they kill, torture, or disappear, that's fine, because, well, they're supposed to be the good guys. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they were the bad guys from day one, and they continue to be bad guys all the way through, and they've killed millions in Rwanda and the Congo ever since, and yet our government still supports them. Yes. And allows this to go on.
Yeah. By the way, I'm really glad you raised this point of people have to get their sort of their timetables correct. The tendency is to say, well, yes, Kagame and his friends have been guilty of crimes since 1994. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a very naive, uninformed way of looking at him, because he and his friends invaded in 1990,
right,
and they began attacking. First of all, creating refugees and then attacking refugee camps during that four-year period. Refugee camps, not just the Rwandan army. They were attacking people who were homeless.
Right. In 1993, they attacked the town of Ruwengeri and killed 40,000 Hutu civilians in 2 weeks in very horrible ways. And nobody in the West mentions that. And when they shot down the plane, which killed the two Hutu presidents and the army chief of staff, they attacked first.
Yes.
And on the 7th and 8th of April, began shelling the big refugee camp just north of Kigali. It had a million Hutus in it. They used high-explosive shells and killed tens of thousands of people to drive them through the city. Those were the first massacres of 1994,
yes,
but nobody talks about it. And the prosecution has all this evidence in their hands. Nobody's ever charged.
Yes. They said it was going to be a look for those guilty of crimes, but only Hutus were charged. That's
right.
And we have several prisoners still sitting in Arusha who were actually found not guilty, who can't even go home. So
that's another world scandal, that even though these men have been acquitted completely, they're still languishing in exile in Tanzania because they can't, and they're virtual prisoners because they can't go anywhere, and they risk being deported to Rwanda at any time.
Yeah, and they risk becoming another Tajiri Bambe.
Exactly, because if they're convinced that if they get sent back to Rwanda, they won't live very long.
Yeah.
And
it is not safe to be in East Africa, given the fact that we have a little group of well-known individuals now who are directing a campaign to hunt down anyone they choose to eliminate.
And if it spreads to here, I mean, you know, they seem to be trying to spread their tentacles further than that, and the governments here don't seem to be willing to stop them too much.
Yeah. Well, so, Christopher Black, it's great talking to you. You have done wonderful work in Arusha. And you certainly clarified this. And I guess you agree, Judy Rever, digitaljournal.com is a good place to start.
She has done some very, really excellent investigative reporting on what really happened in Rwanda and what's going on now. She's worth reading, yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks again.
And you too, of course.
Okay.
I'll let you go.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is Christopher Black. And if you're wondering about the little extra, you know, the cheering and all that for our show, I'm sorry, it actually isn't all that enthusiastic about us. It's we are in Pan American Games country, and I think we have visas. I don't know, but we're allowed to be here, and there's a lot of excitement, and as you know, over the Pan Am Games. and we just happen to be close to some of the people most enthusiastic. Phil Condon is here. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. I really hope people will get in this struggle to try to save the lives of people being murdered and taken off streets by the Kigali government. The gentleman is Tajiri Bambe. I want to say, again, I knew him. He and I used to stay in the same hostel. We discovered a place where we were African investigators, which meant we didn't make as much as other people. The investigators worked for the other team. And so we stayed in a hostel together and overseen by a terrific group of nuns. I don't know. I seem to be – the Catholic Church is really rising these days. Ted Schmidt must be really happy. Did you see that the Pope spoke of capitalism as the devil's dung, which is – see, that puts him ahead of Che. I mean, he's really out there.
And he accepted.
Actually, I think he said greed is the devil's dung.
Yes.
That's good.
He accepted as a gift a very beautiful crucifix that was actually designed by a Jesuit who was martyred by a previous Bolivian government, which was a military dictatorship. It was a crucifix in the form of a hammer and a sickle. And of course, right away, the Western press said, well, the Pope was quite shocked and stuff like that. No, he made it very clear today that he accepted the gift and he was taking it home with him.
Yeah.
So that was very nice.
By the way, yeah, and he also said, if I'm shocked, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
don't put things in my mouth.
Right. And he is letting us know that he's shocked by certain things, such as the lack of attention to environmental issues and by the poverty, by the trafficking of human beings in free trade regimes and stuff like that. He's talking about it all. I mean,
listen, he's got Naomi Klein as an advisor. We're really on a roll. No, that is. It's just remarkable. And he's doing his best to save the reputation and get things back in order. And we did have Ted Schmidt on this program, and who is very militant. And I guess I can use the word Catholic activist. And he said this some months ago when the Pope first came into office, that he's going to be something, and he's quite right. Now, July 16, that's coming up. That's just a couple of days here. On Thursday at 7 to 9 p.m., 746 Bathurst Street, is a tribute to Eduardo Galeano, and it's going to have an open mic. There will be poets there. The feature speaker will be Keith Ellis, whom we've spoken to on this show. I know that we were fascinated by Keith Ellis's pointing out that Galeano had raised the specter of the Paraguayan popular leader of the same era as Bolivar, who had held off the colonialists, and that this was one of the important essays by Galeano. I suspect he will return to that theme. So that's going to be July 16, 7 to 9 p.m., 746 Bathurst Street. There will be poets there, Five Fingers, One Fist. I like that. Whitney French and Faduma Mohammed, Osaz Dolabelli. But there's an open mic, so bring your poem, and you'll have a shot at that. I want to congratulate those who organized the Al Quds Day on Saturday, this past Saturday, on July 11th. It was opposite, they had a march. It was a rally opposite the U.S. consulate on the issue of liberating Al Quds. And a point I think we should keep in mind is that demonstration was inspired by the at the behest and thinking of Imam Khomeini, and for those who have not thought about this, he had a very modern idea, and very much in advance of contemporary thinkers. He said we have to end colonialism completely, and the people of the Middle East, just like the people of South Africa and the place that used to be called Rhodesia, have the right to self-determination. and that you can the colonial powers cannot impose states on the peoples of Asia, Africa, anywhere else. For some reason, people take this as or have tried to hide this his point and turn it into some kind of notion of this is a religious issue. And to a degree, it is, because that is part of the identity of any people. But what he was saying was something that the United Nations itself actually said. He's only reminding them and reminding them of their resolutions on the Middle East tends to inflame people, because we're supposed to move on from what we voted to do. Oh, never mind that. We're going to just move on, you know. And that was a revelation for people that Khomeini took this position. And so anyway, I'm very glad they did that. And I think it contributes to raise the spirits of people who have suffered oppression, particularly the Palestinian people. And I think I've got all the announcements. We have the 26th of July will be at the Steelworker Hall, and that's 2 to 6 p.m. And there will be on August the 6th at the Church of Holy Trinity, west side of Eaton Center, the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And for those of you who like myself, get a little tired of seeing people in camouflage standing in front of baseball crowds and being lauded and being described as warriors. Always, we're warriors. We've got to remember we're a warrior people. Well, the guy who dropped the atom bomb was a warrior. That's what they would call him. Oh, there's one of our warriors. So he pulled the trigger and he dropped the bomb and destroyed a city. And he's a warrior. So people have to remember, we're in a nuclear age. And, you know, you're not running around with knives in your teeth, you know, jumping on the sides of pirate ships. You're annihilating populations. And I can tell this story again. Phil's heard it 100 times. I was reading an article by a Japanese scholar trying to remind the world of those crimes, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he said he was a philosopher by training, and he had spent his adult life going over the issue of why. He said, I understand, you know, hatred and fury of war. They dropped one bomb on Hiroshima. But he said, I always ask myself, why did they drop the second bomb? Why did they do that? And he said, it took me many years of thinking about it, and I finally realized why they dropped the second bomb. It's because they only had two. So I think he got it right. This is the Taylor Report, and you can write to us, Taylor at CIT.fm. And I want to thank David Hoyle and Christopher Black and, of course, Phil Conlon and Hanny, thank you, and we'll see you next week.